It's me, Alison Thompson, aka The Proof Fairy, and this is another episode of Conversations with Authors. Thank you for joining me. This podcast is my opportunity to talk to some wonderful authors about what inspired them to start writing and what tips they would give other aspiring writers. Today is Peter Jones. No, not the dragon, but the author of three novels and five self-help books, including the fabulous How to Do Everything and Be Happy. Peter was one of my first clients when I set up as the Proof Fairy, so I'm really excited to catch up with Peter and talk to him about writing. Peter, I am so chuffed to be talking to you today. You were the first podcast victim. No, not victim. First podcast guest in 2014. I can't remember now what books you had out. But now, I mean, you have got, one of your Amazon pages says you're a best-selling self-help guru.
Who wrote that?
Five self-help books out and three, are they rom-coms, chick lit?
Low clip.
Yes. I don't know what you
call them. So tell me about your book. Rom-coms. Yeah. Well, no, hang on. So when was it? We spoke 2014.
Yeah.
So my bookshelf is right here. So definitely my How to Do Everything and Be Happy. That was 2011. My first sort of weight loss book, that came out in 2013. That must have been out as well. Let's have a quick look at the dating book. These are all self-help books, obviously.
Yeah.
2014, How to Start Dating and Stop Waiting came out. Obviously, The Companion Guy came out at the same time. So I probably had four self-help books out.
Yeah.
Let's have a look at my first rom-com, which is the wonderful
Good Guy's Guide to Getting the Girl, which I proofread and which I absolutely loved.
That's how we got to know each other, wasn't
it?
Yeah. That was 2014. So that might just have come out as well, yeah. I know, I remember those days. Remember when I used to send you a chapter chapter at a time?
it did come in dribs and drabs, didn't it? Actually, I proofread How to Do Everything and Be Happy, which is also in my five favourite books ever. But yeah, The Good Guy's Guide to Getting the Girl. Yeah, you sent me a chapter or two at a time over a couple of years, I think, wasn't it? So what inspired you to start writing in the first place?
What inspired me to start writing? I've been writing pretty much my entire life. At the moment I could string two words together, I wanted to, what I used to call when I was a kid, make books. I used to go around to my grandmother's on a Wednesday after school, and she'd hand me a whole load of A4 paper, and I'd fold those sheets of paper in half, take her stapler and staple all the way down the edge to create a blank book, and then I'd start writing that story and drawing the pictures to go along with the story. And when I ran out of pages, the story would come to an abrupt end. And
no happy endings in those books then.
Well, it could have been. It depended on how well I judged the, how many pages I got. And then I would do the cover and I would do the title and I'd write a blurb on the back. And that's what I wanted to do when I grew up. I wanted to make books. Now, obviously, I got distracted along the way, decided that I wanted to become an actor. Then my parents talked me out of that, and I ended up going into banking.
You're fun.
I know. It's amazing how your dreams.
It might have been fun. Sorry, I sounded so so critical.
No, you were right. You were right. That was the right reaction. Over a decade ago now, I lost my wife, and that kind of threw everything up in the air and made me rethink my life at the time, and made me rethink what I wanted to do with my life, and whether or not I was actually happy you know, in credit card banking, depriving the man on the street from his hard-earned wage. Mm-hmm. And so I left credit card banking and picked up, you know, a pen and started writing again. Yeah. And started working on a novel, which Kate had actually started me writing a few years earlier. And that's like we said, that's how I met you. Is because I remember sending a few chapters to an agent to see if she would be interested. I still hadn't actually finished the book at this stage, but I started submitting it anyway. And then she emailed me back and said, I'd never seen so many typos in one chapter or something like that. Along those lines. So I asked my friend Jules if she, I said, you know, she would find me somebody to do some proofreading, and that's how we met, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then I knew her through a business networking organization. So
exactly. And then I started sending you each chapter as I wrote it, and it turned out that agent was right. There never have been that many typos in one chapter.
No, do you know, as a proofreader, when I get a book that has very few mistakes in it, it's really boring. I really like to have one with lots of mistakes, so make sure works. Well,
that's, on that basis, I must be your best customer. So, yeah, and that's it. But, I mean, the funny thing was is that while I was working on that novel, that's when I lost my wife. And, you know, as I said, I sort of like had this sort of big drains up and thought to myself, what do I want to do with my life? And I decided that I wanted to, you know, write books. But that decision, you know, took a few months. And so in the meantime, I was still working in credit card banking. And the particular project that they'd got me involved in didn't actually require me to do anything more than just sit in the room with three young lads who lacked confidence. I was just had to be there if they had any questions, but my presence was enough to sort of to turn these three young lads into superheroes. So I had nothing to do. So I, you know, so I needed to look busy while I was sitting there with my laptop in the corner. And so I thought, oh, well, I'll carry on working on my novel. But the problem is with fiction is that it still looks like fiction when it's laid out on a computer screen. Okay. And I needed something with bullet points and diagrams and headings and subheadings. I needed nonfiction. So I started writing about some ideas that I'd been mulling over on the, you know, on the very nature of happiness. And 6 months later, courtesy of, a bank that can't be named, I accidentally had written How to Do Everything and Be Happy, which I also sent to you for proofreading. And I remember you saying to me when you sent it back, you said to me, I think you might be onto something here. So I self-published that book, and it wasn't, I mean, it was about, I don't know, a year or two later that HarperCollins, they eventually came across the book, and they eventually offered me a book deal, and they brought out what effectively was a second edition, but they didn't market it that way. They marketed it as a brand new book. So,
So then all the other books have come under HarperCollins then? That was that deal to...
No, that one came out by HarperCollins. The other self-help books... well, it was a combination. I sort of self-published them, but also Audible, the audiobook people, they gave me a three-book deal, so they released them an audiobook as well.
Oh, wow. So, is that with you narrating?
Yeah, well, that's a funny story, because I asked them who's going to be reading my book, and they said... they said, we haven't decided yet. And I said, well, you know, are you even thinking about me doing it? And they said, not really sure, you know, sometimes. Well, you know, they said sometimes the author isn't particularly good at reading their own work, and it's better in the hands of a professional actor. And they said, well, they said, I'll tell you what, you can audition if you'd like. So I had to audition to read my own book, which is exactly what I did. But I'm delighted to say they liked what I did or liked how I sounded, so they gave me the job. Yeah. I had to say I wouldn't do it again. I think next time I'd let Audible find an actor.
Really? Was it just boring? Yeah. Was it just really boring to do?
It's terrifying, really. I mean, I'm not adverse to standing up in front of an audience. You know that. I go and do talks all over the shop, and I like, you know, the more people, the better, really. I love talking in front of an audience. But sitting in a dark room, a dark soundproofed room on your own with nothing but an iPad in front of you, and, you know, occasionally a voice in your headphones telling you that you'd made a mistake is absolutely terrifying. I wouldn't do it again.
Although, thinking about it, this crazy time of the pandemic, we're probably all quite used to sitting on our own in rooms talking to a screen, aren't we?
Yes, but you can see the other person at the other end and you know they're not going to judge you. Imagine if you were, you know, imagine if you couldn't see the other person at the other end and occasionally you just had somebody go, no, you made a mistake.
Oh, no.
Go back and read that again.
You know, soulless. Completely soulless.
Yes. Yeah. I know.
So, obviously, you write two very different kinds of books. You've got the rom-com fiction and you've got the self-help books. How do you go about writing them? What do you have a sort of process? Do you plan? Are you a pantser? How do you do it?
The self-help, I approached that pretty much in the same way that I used to write anything when I was at credit card banking. So I start organising my thoughts into bullet points.
Yeah.
And then put those into some sort of logical order, and then I expand the bullet points and expand them a bit more and expand them a bit more. Obviously, you know, I don't make it as dry and dull and boring as the stuff I used to write when I was a banker, but you know, I inject as much humor into it as possible.
Thank goodness.
But that's how I write. Non-fiction is an awful lot easier to do than fiction. So,
right.
So basically that's how that comes about. Fiction is a completely different approach, really. Although that said, I still start with a bullet point, with bullet pointed outline of what I want to write. I know where the plot is going to go. So I know where I'm starting, I know what the middle is going to be, and I know what the end's going to be.
Right.
And then I put that into a bullet pointed outline. And then it's changed over the years, but what I did with the book that I'm working on now is I then wrote about 5 or 6 pages of A4, which is what they would call in the film industry a treatment. Do you know what I mean? So it's basically me describing the story to you, not telling the story, just describing it. So it's really not that interesting. It's just like me say, you know, this person goes there, then they meet this other person, they have a conversation about this, so they discover this thing and they decide they're going to do this particular action and so on and so forth. And I did that. And that took about a month. And then I actually sit down and start writing chapter by chapter.
Mm. Do you keep really detailed records of your characters along the way, and you know, who's with who and who likes football and who likes crisps and all the kind of foibles that they have, so you don't get them mixed up?
Not characters in such. I've never needed to do that. Not in terms of what they like and who they are. That sort of information is just in my head.
Right.
One of the things that I do fairly early on, which my partner Valerie really loves getting involved in, is we say, okay, if this was going to be made into a Hollywood movie and we have the magical ability to cast any actor from any period in history, you know, who would we get to play this role? So you can say, oh, a young Denzel Washington would be good for this role, or, you know, or
okay,
or an old Jack Nicholson or something like that. And then we do that, we cast all the characters, and then I find pictures of those people at the ages that I need them to be on the internet. I download those pictures and I print them all off, and then I stick them to a pinboard which lives in my office. So I've got all of my characters from the book I'm working on sitting to the right of me. And That really helps me to get into the mindset of who these people are. So their foibles and what they like and how they speak and that sort of stuff, that's all in my head. But what I do keep detailed notes on is when are they born, what's their birthday, when did they go to school, and the various events that happened during the course of their lifetime and how those interact with events, other character events and things like that.
Okay, so you basically have a photograph of them or of the person that will play them, and then a kind of life CV.
And one of the things I've been doing ever since the first book is working out exactly what day in history does each scene take place on. And the spreadsheet works out what day of the week it is, so I don't have to worry about that. And
is this so you can then bring in real life, real events that happened on
them? Yeah, as much as possible. I like to do that. As much as possible, I like to do that. But more than that, what not many of my readers have figured this out, though a few have, all of the books are in exactly the same world. So every now and then, certain events in the books cross with certain events in the other books. So they do actually all start to, and some of the characters in one book would suddenly turn up in the next book, and so on and so forth. And each book references back to events that have been referenced in other stories. But not a lot of my readers have figured that out yet. But when I brought out the third book, a couple would started to say, oh, hang on a moment, is this the same person who was in this one or that one?
Now you've just given it away, so everyone will have to go back now and read the books again and see where those characters.
Well, that would be nice. Yeah, go read them again. Yeah.
Go and buy them again. You said that you had to do everything and be happy. Came out originally self-published, and then it was by HarperCollins, and then you had an Audible contract for 3 books. How did you publish the rest of them and the fiction? Have you gone the self-publishing route through Amazon with that? Or
so the self-help books, of which there are 5 now, with the exception of How to Do Everything and Be Happy, the other 4 were all, I self-published those through my own little publishing company called South Haven Books. And then The Good Guy's Guide to Getting the Girl, I self-published originally, again, under the same publishing company. And then I was disappointed originally with the sales of that book. So I decided that perhaps I should try and get a publisher interested again, this time in my fiction.
Yeah.
So I started sending the book out, even though it had already been finished and self-published. I started sending it out to agents anyway and was surprised that it didn't seem to make a jot of difference that it was self-published. In actual fact, most of them wanted to know what the sales were like. And one lady came back to me, Peter Nightingale, who was at LAW at the time, and she said, I really like this, could you come in and have a chat with me? And I went and saw her. This was a few years ago, and ended up signing 2 contracts, one for her to represent me as my agent, and the second one was effectively a publicity deal with Amazon themselves. So at the time, Amazon had a sort of hybrid scheme where they would take self-published authors who were represented by an agent, and then they would give them the same publicity opportunities that they usually only give to the big publishers. I was in month-long deals and giveaways and whatever else they were doing. It was called White Glove. I'm not even sure they still do that now. That really boosted the sales of that book. And my second book, The Truth About This Charming Man, second fiction book, that too ended up being picked up by or being chosen by Amazon to be one of their white glove books. And that was where I thought things were going. And then my agent turned around to me a few years back now and said, I don't want to be an agent anymore. I've decided to jack it all in. And instead, I'm going to be head of new talent at the newly formed Bookature, you know, which you've probably heard of. And so that was it. Suddenly I was without an agent, which meant I was no longer represented by Amazon's white glove scheme.
And
I was back to square one. I wasn't disheartened. I've been here before many times. So I brought out my third fiction book, which was called My Girlfriend's Perfect Ex-Boyfriend. But once again, realised very quickly that self-publishing is, whilst it's easy to get a book on a shelf, getting the actual book sales is a struggle if you're on your own, because you're effectively doing everything. You know, you're not just the author, but you're the publicity person and the marketing person, and you know, you're everything. And I was back to the sort of sales which most self-published authors experience, you know, tens of books a month rather than hundreds. So when I finished My Girlfriend's Perfect Ex-Boyfriend, I thought to myself, that's it, I'm not doing this again. So instead, everything I've written since, I've decided I'm not going to self-publish, and I'm back to submitting to agents and trying to get a publishing deal.
So presumably that means there is another book that you're sending out at the moment? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there is. Yeah. It's tentatively, well, the working title is The MI5 Girls.
Okay.
And it's a little different from my previous three works of fiction. This one isn't a romantic comedy. I suppose you would call it women's contemporary fiction / spy thriller. It's a bit sort of like Killing Eve / I mean, I suppose that's really the closest to what it is, you know. / Enola Holmes / The Queen's Gambit, that sort of thing, that, you know.
That's bang on trend then, I guess.
Well, yeah. I hope so. I hope so. And I've been sending it out now for a little while, but I'm getting some nice feedback, and I've been asked for the full manuscript a couple of times, got a couple of agents considering the full manuscript at the moment. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed. I was hoping actually that by the time we had this chat, I'd be able to give you some good news, but but you know how these things are. What with the pandemic and everything,
everything's
taking 10 times longer than you'd expect it to. So
it'll get there, I'm sure. So how has becoming an author changed your life? Has it kind of taken you anywhere surprising, anywhere that you didn't expect it to take you?
Surprising. Well, I'm happier than I've ever been. So that's
good. That's
good start. I'm also poorer than I've ever been.
That's not so good.
I mean it is surprising, because I suppose I didn't expect to end up doing an awful lot of talks for groups and societies and that sort of thing up until we all went down into lockdown. About three times a week I would pack up a suitcase full of books, and I'd disappear off for the afternoon or evening and go and talk to a women's institute or a U3A or a retirement club or a Rotary club, or you know, any kind of organization, any organization that would have me, and I would entertain them with stories of how I came to write my books and that sort of thing. And I didn't expect that to happen. Been on the radio numerous times. Didn't expect, you know, didn't expect that either. So yeah, it's been an interesting decade.
Yeah. And didn't you start up workshops around how to do everything and be happy?
Back in the early days, after the original version was published in 2011, and pretty soon after, I was asked if I would run a workshop, and then I was asked if I would run a regular workshop, like once a month. And yeah, I did that for a couple of years. I used to run happiness workshops. I wasn't really expecting that. But I soon realised that. Although they were fun, it wasn't really what I wanted to do, you know, because right. I think when you run a workshop, you really have to be quite a diplomat. You have to be, you know, because people come with problems and challenges that they're facing, and you have to be diplomatic when dealing with those sort of things. And that isn't something I'm particularly good at.
Having spent most of my
professional life in credit card banking, where my job was to fix problems, I was used to sort of like identifying what the problem was, identifying a solution, and stating in no uncertain terms, this is what you should do now. And when you run a workshop, that is not the approach that you should take.
And I guess not.
No, and I did frighten a couple of people off. You know, I remember one lady coming to my workshop. She said, "Oh, I've always wanted to be a writer." And I thought to myself, "Well, now here is something I can definitely help with." And I said, "Well, Sharon," I don't know whether that was what her name was, I can't remember now. I said, "Next time you come back next month, I want you to bring your opening chapter. I don't care how long it is. It can be really short. You know, it doesn't matter if it sucks. You know, just come back next month with your opening chapter. Can you do that?" And she looked absolutely terrified. And I said, "Come on, how hard can that be? You've got an entire month to write an opening chapter." And I never, ever saw her ever again.
Oh dear. Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? I mean, when my book came out, I kind of went into doing speaking gigs and ran a one, it was about ADHD, and I ran a one day event for parents, which was brilliant fun. And I did some workshops that were quite good fun. And then I did some one-to-one stuff with people that I absolutely hated. And I just thought, this is not the way for me to be going. It's funny how, you write a book and then all these opportunities open up to you, but it's kind of sorting through and realizing that you don't have to do everything just because it's there. You kind of, some things aren't actually what you want to do at all.
It is a hard way to make a living. So most successful authors I know have to do something else as well. And an awful lot of them teach things like creative writing and that sort of thing. Mm. But that in itself is another skill. Just because you can string words together and turn it into a book doesn't necessarily make you a fabulous teacher. And I think I'm relatively good in telling stories. So I'm far more comfortable standing in front of 1,300 people and telling them, you know, entertaining them, telling them a story, dealing with the hecklers. I can cope with that. But when it's a workshop environment where, you know, you've got to be a bit more touchy-feely, then I can do it, but I'm not sure I do it as well as lots of other people. So I can understand what you're saying, that once you got to a one-to-one thing, I can't even imagine that.
There's safety in numbers, definitely, isn't there? I think it's a lot easier to speak to 300 people than it is to speak to six people in a tiny local library. Yeah,
absolutely. You just hit the nail on the head, because what I was thinking then when we were talking about that was, like, tonight, for instance, it's our monthly writing group meeting, and there's only half a dozen of us in the group, okay? And I'm like known as the Simon Cowell of the group, and more than once I've made one of my fellow writing group members cry, which I feel terrible about, because I just can't help but say what I really think about something. Or even if I think, you know, this is good, but it could be so much better if you did A, B, C, and D, you know, and then I find out later I just made them cry and I feel terrible.
They've gone home and burned their manuscript as a result of what you've said.
Alison, I hate it when I get an email. Every now and then I get an email from somebody who's struggling to write, you know, and they want some advice and they send me a chapter or something and they say, can you tell me what you think of this? And I'm like, oh no, why did you do that? Because
I like it.
I'm faced with the decision. Do I tell this person the truth or, you know, which they might not want to hear? In fact, they probably won't. Or do I lie my head off and tell them what they've written is an absolute work of, you know.
Oh dear. Yeah.
What would you do?
I actually find myself in that position sometimes. So obviously I proofread. I get sent, you know, I proofread probably at least a dozen books a year, I guess.
Yeah.
And normally people don't actually say to me, what do you think of it? So I proofread it, I edit it, I tidy it up, I make it as good a read as I can do with the content I've been given. Yeah. Occasionally somebody says to me, you know, can you proofread this? And can you let me know what you think of it? And I have to admit, yeah, I do. I give them both barrels about what they think of it. There's a guy who I've actually interviewed for one of these podcasts, Alan Owen. I'm sure we talk about it in the interview, so I'm sure he won't mind me talking about it now. He's writing a book about life following a nuclear holocaust. He kind of has a background in nuclear testing, so he's writing this book. And yeah, he said to me, could you proofread this and can you tell me, you know, tell me what you think of it as well? Give me your feedback. I got to the end and I said, well, nothing really happens, does it? You know, there's no jeopardy.
I mean, apart from the massive, great big explosion.
Well, there's an explosion. And then this man just kind of lives in his basement. And he goes out now and then, but then he comes back again and nothing happens while he's out. You know?
Hang on. Isn't that called literary fiction?
Well, yeah, maybe, yes.
He'll probably win a prize for that.
He probably will, yeah. But you know, he took it on board. He said, yeah, I did ask you to tell me what you thought of it. And I've actually given it to somebody else and they've said exactly the same thing. So he's
well done,
adding some stuff to it to make sure something happens. But yeah, I mean, it is difficult, isn't it? Because, yeah, I don't want to lie. I don't want to say to something, yeah, it's amazing, it's brilliant, when I'm thinking, eek, this is not thing I've ever read.
On that note, I don't want somebody to lie to me. I don't want people to say, oh, it's so good, I really enjoyed it, if they thought it was diabolical. You know, and in the early days with my partner Val, you know, we ended up having a row about this because I said to her, well, I gave her something to read, she came back and said, oh yeah, I really enjoyed it. I gave it to somebody else, a fellow author, who then came back and said, no, I think it's trash. I think you can do a lot better.
Yeah.
I said to Val, my God, they just told me this. And she said, yes, I did think that, actually.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you use beta readers, but you have to be really careful who you choose in that role. Because, yeah, I mean, if I give my book to my mum, she's going to say, it's wonderful, I love it, because she's my mum. But, yeah, you need to make sure you give it to people who are, A, going to read it independent of what they think of you, and B, are not really afraid to give you honest critique on it, yeah. Because you don't want people coming back saying it's really good. You want people coming back saying, well, I like this, but actually there's an awful lot you could do to make it better.
Yeah. I once heard a fantastic piece of advice for authors that said, you know, when you hand your book to somebody else and ask for their thoughts, what you should say is, what's wrong with it? Because you're not really interested in hearing it's good. That's not actually any use whatsoever. No. What you want to know is what's wrong with it. If the other person struggles to think of anything, well, that's a good sign. But otherwise, you want to encourage them to find as many faults in it as possible. That said, some of my beta readers over the years, because they know that's what I want, sometimes they can get into a kind of habit where they start to pick out things which they think other people might not like. So they say, I'm not sure other people will like this bit. I said, well, what do you think of it? Oh, I thought it was fine. And I'm like,
but what? How can you say what someone else will or won't like? Yeah, you can only.
Well, this is a thing in the publishing industry. And one of the frustrating things I have with agents and publishers over the years is that they're constantly, both agents and publishers, are second guessing what they think the man on the street who buys the book at the end of the day will think. They're thinking, right, well, maybe the man on the street will think this. And I've had conversations over the years where I go, well, yeah, but what do you think? And they go, oh, no, I like it, but I'm a bit worried that, you know, blah, blah, whatever. Ugh. Yeah, I know.
That's difficult, isn't it?
It's like the book I'm just submitting now, for instance, I had a conversation with an agent not so long ago, and she absolutely loved the book, and she wanted to represent me as well. But then she said, I love it, but your protagonist is 18, and the man that she ultimately falls in love with is twice her age. And she said, and I think that's going to be a hard sell for American readers.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, really? And she said, it would be fine if we were trying to sell this to Netflix. They wouldn't have a problem with it. But people buying a book would expect her to be 25 and him to be 30. And the book's like based in 1983. And it's hard to imagine that a spy is going to be, you know, somebody who's like a dyed-in-the-wool spy who's been around for a while is going to be only 30 years old. You know, and if she's 25, because she's supposed to be this young, naive, you know, it just didn't ring true. Yeah. And in the end, I said, I think I'm going to have to look for representation elsewhere, because I think that would compromise the story too much.
Yeah. That's the thing, isn't it? You know what the aim of your book is, and it sounds like if someone else is trying to shoehorn it into something else, they're not the right person.
Yeah,
looking for, yeah, you. And believe in your book as it is, haven't they?
And well, true, yeah. But I mean, and it's difficult, because it's, on the one hand, that is why agents and publishers exist. You know, they know their market and they know what they can, who they can sell a book to. But on the other hand, that happens quite a lot, where, you know, a certain genre perhaps has become the latest thing. And from that moment on, both agents and publishers are trying to shoehorn every single book that comes their way into that genre so that they can sell it effectively. Right.
So what sort of advice would you give to other people who are thinking about writing, whether it's fiction or self-help?
What advice would I give? The most obvious piece of advice is to sit down in your chair and write, and you know, write anything as well. I think time and time again I meet people who they really, really want to write a book. But what scares them is the blank page. And so they sit down in front of their computer, they write a line, they read it back to themselves, and they think, God, no, that's trash. So they delete that, and then they start again. And maybe they get a paragraph, and then they read it and say, my God, this is awful. You know, and they never get past that first page. And that's not ever going to work. What you have to do, and this was one of the best pieces of advice that was ever given to me, was that you need to sit down, start writing from the beginning of your story, write all the way to the end. And when you type the word the end, then you go back to the start, and then you start fixing all the stuff, you know, that you've screwed up along the way. Yeah. That first chapter, that opening chapter, will probably not look anything like the first draft, but you need to just write a first draft in order to move you on to chapter two, and then chapter three and chapter four. So back in the days, Alison, when I was sort of like writing a chapter and then sending it to you to proofreading, that was idiocy. That was ridiculous. If I could get in a time machine and go back in time, I'd stop myself from doing that and say, no, you can't do that. Write the whole damn book first, then go back and rewrite it. Because I mean, you're not gonna realize this, but the first draft, and you edited every single chapter that I sent to you, was 200,000 words long.
Wow, was it really? Gosh,
yeah.
that is quite a manuscript. Got a bit at a time, so I didn't realize it was that long. Wow.
But the thing was, what you probably didn't realize is that what I actually did in the end, following the advice that I'd been given by a number of author friends of mine, was I cut it in half.
Okay.
The book that's actually ended up getting published was the first half of the story. I had to come up with this ending so that it would end, so the story would end. But somewhere sitting on my desk under a pile of papers is the entire second half of that original book.
Gosh, so that's a book too, surely. I'm going to go back now because I've read the book. But I read the book several years after I worked on it. So, and you know, I'd worked on so many things in the meantime that I can't remember.
Yeah.
I know he was called Jason, and I know she was called Melanie, and he was a photographer, and I remember bits and pieces, but not the whole story. So yeah, I'm going to go back now, read the book, and then dig out the files, which I will still have in my drive.
And compare them,
yeah, and see at what point it ends and what's missing.
Yeah.
Wow, didn't know that. Yeah, but no, you're quite right in terms of, yeah, I think people write a paragraph and then edit it, and apart from anything, your brain, you use different parts of the brain for writing and for editing, don't you? And when you're switching between the creative part and the more analytical part, you never get into that flow of doing either of them very well.
Well, I mean, to a certain degree, I still do that now. I still write a paragraph, then rewrite it again. That, I think, is absolutely fine. Okay, there's nothing wrong with that. What I think will kill you when you start writing is if you write a line, think, oh, my goodness, that's not good enough, and then get stuck. Do you see what I mean? What you've got to do is you've got to push yourself forwards.
Right, yeah.
Another thing which it took me a long time to do, and it wasn't until a friend of mine called Ian Patterson, who's quite a successful author in his own right, he'd worked out my word count, my hourly word count. He said, you're writing about 200 words an hour.
Yeah.
And he said, which is pitiful. <He's>, he said, and you've really got, you know, you can't afford to do that. You've got to up your word count. What Ian didn't realise, though, was that it averaged out at 200 words an hour. And in fact, when I analysed it, the first 3 hours of any given writing day, I'd probably write about 100 words. And then most of the words that I would do for that day would be done in the second and the fourth or fifth hour. But because he told me this, I started counting the number of words that I write per hour and try to get it well over the 200 if I can. And in doing so, that drives me forward. And I use a spreadsheet to calculate how long it's going to take me to finish this book based on the rate at which I wrote the previous chapters. So each day I enter the number of words that I've, the total number of words, and it works out how many words I've written since the last time. And because it knows the start date, it can then work out the finish date. And at the moment, the book I'm writing at the moment is due to be finished on the 8th of October. And remember, that's first draft.
Oh, gosh. So, wow. Yeah.
I know. So that's
slow progress. Yeah.
It is slow progress.
In your banking days, did you do a lot with spreadsheets?
Yes.
So this is what's
what made you
from banking through to being an author. Spreadsheet.
Yeah, well, no, I think I said this in How to Do Everything and Be Happy. I don't think there's a problem in the world that can't be solved with a good Excel spreadsheet.
I think you do say that, yeah. It's been really fantastic catching up with you today. I want to know what's next for you. So you've got this MI5 girl. So this one is due to be finished on October the 8th.
No, that one, the MI5 Girls, he's finished, edited and everything.
Oh, okay.
That's the one that's being submitted at the moment, but you can't stop there. And so I'm already about a third of the way through the sequel.
Oh, okay. All right, then. There's more books after to come after that, or?
Yeah, it's, well, I know that these books are all part of I suppose they're part of a series, and I know at the moment in my head it's a 4-book series, and I know what happened each of those stories, so I'm going to just keep writing and get those books all in the can, to borrow a phrase from photography. Mm-hmm. And if and when I actually get a publishing deal, it means that I'll have some books there ready to go. Yeah, ready to edit or rewrite or what have you.
Yeah, so, and yeah. Are there going to be any more self-help books?
Well, my last one, which was called How to Eat Loads and Lose Weight, I wrote, I think, about a year and a half ago, something like that. Let's have a look. Just before we went into lockdown, I self-published that one. Let's have a quick look. Yeah, it was published in 2020. And I wrote that one after I finished the first draft of the novel that I'm currently sending out. I wanted a rest. I wanted a break.
You wanted a break from writing, so you wrote another book. Yeah.
I wanted a break from writing fiction.
Yeah. Back to the easier bullet points of nonfiction.
Right. So when I went back to writing, went back to editing, I'd be fresh. Do you see what I mean? I wanted a bit of distance between me and the novel. So in between times, I wrote another self-help book. And that worked really well because I noticed that I could write nonfiction an awful lot quicker. I wrote this entire book, which I'm extremely proud of. And who knows, maybe when I finish the novel that I'm writing at the moment and I need a bit of space between first draft and starting the editing, maybe I'll write another nonfiction book. At some point, I would like to write another book on happiness.
Okay.
Because I'm still sort of playing around with different ideas on happiness and that sort of stuff. So that I've got some ideas about that. So yeah.
How to do even more and be even happier.
Yes, good title.
I'll put the invoice in the post. Like honestly, it's been so lovely talking to you today. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
For doing this for the second time. And you never know, I might relaunch it again in another 8 years' time and we could do a third interview. Before you go, where can people find you online?
You can find me personally by just Googling Peter Jones author, and I should come right up there at the top, or you can type peterjonesauthor.com into Google and that will definitely bring me up at the top. And obviously if you type my name, or even better, any of the titles of my books into Amazon, then you can find my Amazon author page by just clicking through and following the links.
Brilliant. And find all those books on there. Thank you so much. It's been fabulous, Peter.
You're very welcome.
Thank you to Peter for being my guest on the podcast today. You can find out more about him and his books on his website, www.peterjonesauthor.com, or search for him on Amazon. You can find out more about me and the services I offer authors on my website, www.theproofairy.com. If you like this podcast, then please subscribe to it, review it, rate it, and tell your friends about it. This has been a Proof Fairy production, once again in collaboration with my dogs. And I'll be back next week with another inspiring interview with another amazing author.